7BR Part Heard. Hello, and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Rhys Palmer, Chambers Paralegal. We're joined today by Joshua Yetman, who is here today to talk to us about strikeouts in the Employment Tribunal and his recent appearance in the Employment Appeal Tribunal, in which he successfully argued to have a strikeout order set aside. Josh is one of Chambers' most recent tenants, having completed his pupillage in October 2020. Whilst he currently has a mixed practice, he has particular experience in employment law. Prior to pupillage, Josh worked as an assistant legal officer for the Free Representation Unit, where he specialised in employment law. This saw him both supervise volunteers representing claimants in the Employment Tribunal and representing claimants himself in more complex trials. He also appeared in the Employment Appeal Tribunal twice whilst at Free. Since joining Chambers, Josh has been instructing a number of multi-day hearings in the Employment Tribunal. Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Rhys. Thanks for having me.
So we're here today to discuss strikeouts and a recent case that you're in, Collins and Ultimate Finance Group Limited. Before we delve into the discussion of your case, perhaps you could just set out the test that needs to be satisfied for a strikeout to be made.
So the test for strikeout in the Employment Tribunal is set out in Rule 37 of the Employment Tribunal Procedure Rules. Now, this case and what we'll be talking about are the circumstances in which the tribunal can strike out of its own initiative under that rule. So we're not dealing with an application by the other party. So under Rule 37.1, of course, where the tribunal decides of its own initiative to do that, it can strike out where certain conditions are met. And the relevant condition in this case was for non-compliance with any of these rules or with an order of the tribunal. So we're dealing with paragraph C of Rule 37. And the issue was failure to comply with an order of the tribunal, and we'll come to what that was about shortly. Also an issue was whether or not, in exercising that discretion to strike out, a reasonable opportunity had been given to the claimant to make representations as to strike out. So in short, the case was firstly about the exercise of discretion under Rule 37C, and secondly, in exercise of that discretion, whether or not the claimant had been given a reasonable opportunity to make representations. And that informed the grounds of appeal, and we won on both counts.
And as I'm sure our listeners know, anybody who's done any sort of civil procedure rules know that strikeouts are quite sort of a draconian step for the courts to take.
Yes. I mean, the key issue, of course, is because behind this, what this means is the claimant can't pursue their claim. And so the reason it's approached with caution ordinarily is because the net outcome, of course, if you go straight to strikeout, is someone can't litigate an issue and obtain a remedy that they might otherwise have been able to obtain. So generally, they're approached with caution, and hence why these principles, if they're not complied with, the decision to strike out can be knocked out itself.
So you've sort of touched upon my next question there, that the strikeout can be set aside, as it were. How is that possible? What's the sort of process and procedure that goes through with that?
So in terms of setting aside those decisions, the key question is the application of the principles in the case of Weir Values and Control Limited against Armitage. It's known as Armitage, and Armitage is a pretty seminal case in this area. And so really it sets out the questions that a court will ask where a decision to strike out has been made. Firstly, the question is whether or not the fair trial is still possible. Secondly, whether or not the overriding objective has been met. And in that, of course, it's looking at the fairness between the parties, the magnitude of any default, and any prejudice caused to any party. Thirdly, whether any less punitive measure could be applied. And less punitive, for example, would be maybe a costs order being made or another requirement being followed, as opposed to the strikeout. And also principles analogous to those applied in the CPR are also considered. For example, relief from sanctions. Is there a background to the case that would allow a party to apply for relief? And lastly, proportionality. Is the step in the circumstances of the case proportional?
And so this is presumably the test and the steps that you had to go through to satisfy your case that was recently finished. Could you perhaps just give us a bit of a background to that case and the arguments that you were putting before the tribunal?
Yes, of course. So this was an issue to do with the schedule of loss. So I represented a claimant in the EAT. I wasn't involved in the employment tribunal, but the claimant had been required to provide a schedule of loss. Of course, that's setting out the remedy that the claimant was hoping to obtain in the employment tribunal. So there was a deadline, and that deadline was in September of 2019. Now, the appellant's representative had failed to meet that deadline. And in fact, 3 weeks after the deadline had passed, the respondent had applied for something called an unless order, which is important, and maybe we'll come back to that. But essentially, that means the respondent had asked the tribunal to require a schedule to be provided by a certain date, and failure to do that would result in either cost consequences or possibly strikeout. After that, 4.5 weeks after the deadline for the schedule, the employment tribunal judge sent an email to the parties, and that's 4.5 weeks after, and that set out really the requirement to provide the schedule of loss, but importantly, it was not an unless order. So it's an important context in that the respondent had asked for an unless order and hadn't got one, and yet four and a half weeks after, the employment judge had written out an email to the claimant noting that one should be provided by return, and that's an important term that maybe we'll come back to. After that, some 5.5 weeks after the deadline, the appellant's representative explained the delay to the tribunal. There were personal circumstances and a family bereavement that had meant the deadline couldn't be met. In effect, the schedule was ultimately provided 6 weeks after that deadline. And so that's the background to this case. We're dealing with a schedule of loss required by a certain date that wasn't provided for 6 weeks.
And that's where the strikeout then came into play.
Exactly. So on that basis, funnily enough, the day that the schedule was in fact provided, the decision to strike out was handed down, and that date was the 8th of November 2019. So the question then was, how reasonable was that decision to strike out in the face of the reasons that the representative had given, namely the family bereavement?
And so what were the sort of implications of this appeal then?
Well, in terms of the grounds that were raised by this appeal, in general, the strongest ground, and we actually succeeded on this in addition to a couple of others, but was just a fundamental failure to apply those relevant principles that I've set out. And so really, it makes clear the importance of following those principles in Armitage. And by following, I mean explicitly. And so the first grounds essentially said, well, you need to apply these principles when exercising the discretion. And a failure to provide evidence of those principles being considered meant that that discretion hadn't been properly exercised. So firstly, it reiterates the importance of the Armitage principles. And even though it's a case dating back to 2004, it makes clear that if employment tribunals do not follow those principles, even where a schedule or a step isn't carried out for 6 weeks past the deadline, the Employment Appeal Tribunal will go behind that decision. And that's so that it really does highlight the necessity and the need for these principles to be considered. The other thing I'd say is that along with that, where practitioners find that they've fallen foul of a deadline or a requirement of an order, give reasons. It's very important that even if it's anticipated that the deadline won't be met, or even if it hasn't been met, if information is provided to the tribunal in relation to why that deadline hasn't been met, personal circumstances or other issues, the tribunal should consider that. And if they don't, it's likely there'll be a route to an appeal. The other key point I'd say is that it came up in oral argument in terms of the application of the approach of the civil courts to rules and how strict they may or may not be in the employment tribunal. And along that vein, the ultimate outcome was that the approach still remains that employment tribunal rules should not be applied with the same rigidity as the civil procedure rules. And that remains the case. There was discussion about whether or not authorities such as Hassan and EAT decision and Bearley, a Court of Appeal decision, had developed. And the ultimate outcome was no, in that it's still right that CPR, obviously in a standalone jurisdiction, will bring a different approach to the strictness that's applied to the ET rules. The basic point being, employment tribunal procedure rules will be applied more flexibly than the CPR.
So what that sort of suggests is the reasonableness may be, as you say, more flexible in the EAT than it would in a civil proceedings.
Well, Well, certainly in terms of whether or not a party has complied with a rule, it's fair to say that there's a broader discretion, I think, in the employment tribunal, and that remains the case. And that's generally accepted, it's important to say. That's not a major revelation. It's just that this case raised it in the context of the strikeout decision being made, and the judge was interested to know whether or not there was any authority to the contrary, and it remains the case that there isn't. I think it's also worth saying that where an unless order has not been given, and of course an unless order is that requirement of a party to carry out a certain step by a certain date, and if there's a failure to do so, then there will be a strikeout, for example, or cost consequences. Where that unless order has not been made, to strike out a claim on the basis of a failure to do something is a very, very extreme step. And so it's just worth saying to practitioners that absent an unless order, robust communication with the tribunal is advisable, because without parties being given those warnings, particularly claimants, I think a decision to strike out, absent very good reason to do so, will be considered unreasonable and therefore an unlawful application of the discretion.
Just touching on the lack of unless order in this particular circumstances, what was the sort of reasoning behind the unless order not actually being given despite requested by the respondent?
Well, in truth, there was no explanation for why an unless order wasn't given. The email that I referred to that the ET sent out before the decision to strike out was made was not compliant with Rule 38 of the Employment Tribunal Procedure Rule. So it just was not an unless order, and it didn't explain why it wasn't. What it did do is attempt to give an opportunity for the claimant to comply. So it was sort of an unless order through the back door, in that it was said in the correspondence that the claimant should provide a response and attach the schedule by return. And I mentioned that earlier. Now, the Employment Tribunal judge latterly said that by return necessarily meant 5 p.m. the next day. Now, of course, the EAT took the view that that was not a reasonable opportunity to provide a response by, or that meant that the claimant wasn't given a reasonable opportunity to provide a response. And so there wasn't compliance with any notice requirement for strikeout. It frankly moved too fast, and the outcome was too serious to render it a reasonable decision. Hence, it was overturned.
So just overall then, if you were to give one final practical piece of advice in these circumstances, I know you've already given a few here, what would that be to our practitioner listeners?
Well, obviously, the first piece of advice has to be, where there are deadlines, meet them, of course. This isn't a decision that's saying you don't need to comply with orders of the tribunal. But broadly speaking, I think it highlights the importance of contacting the tribunal and explaining what is going on when it is going on. And for that reason, where that's done, any decisions and knee-jerk reactions to strike out can be reasonably contested. So it just highlights the importance of, if you cannot meet a deadline, outline why. And even if you fail to do that, this discretion is a discretion that, if not exercised appropriately, the EAT will go behind it. So make sure that employment tribunals are following these steps, because if they aren't, you have a right to appeal.
Sounds something good for claimants or appellants who haven't necessarily had legal representation all the way through a claim then.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's not only for unrepresented claimants, but also claimants represented by sole practitioners, which was the case here. You know, there are individuals out there with caseloads that are mounting. And of course, juggling many balls, it's difficult to meet all the deadlines all of the time. So yes, it certainly highlights the importance with limited resources of setting out what's going on as it happens instead of going quiet.
Well, thanks, Josh, for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you on.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this week's episode of Part Heard, you can find more like this on Chambers' website or across other streaming platforms such as Spotify and Apple Music. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.